Hi, welcome to Books Plus. I'm Kate Evans, and on today's bookshelf, you can travel to Delhi, to Melbourne, to a dystopian future defined by music, and on to the newsstands of the 1940s and 1950s. Because the cheapest and most popular books were sold on newsstands rather than in bookshops, and they weren't even necessarily available in libraries. They were pulp fiction because the covers were paper rather than cardboard. They weren't meant to last. And thanks to Quentin Tarantino, I guess, and before that, Raymond Chandler and others, it's too easy to presume this type of publishing happened primarily in America. There was a thriving pulp publishing industry based in Sydney. An exhibition has just opened at the State Library of New South Wales, Pulp Confidential, Quick and Dirty Publishing from the 40s and 50s. And guest curator Peter Doyle spoke to Michael Cathcart, explaining what this term pulp means.
It's pulp everything, fiction and non-fiction, and there's quite a bit of non-fiction, but very pulpy.
Oh, what's pulp non-fiction, like true crime?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The covers were actually, all the energy was on the covers, and the stories inside often didn't live up to, anywhere near live up to the promise of the covers. The
you
covers
mean they weren't as salacious?
No, they weren't. They weren't. And in some cases, they were so, you might say disappointingly unsalacious as to, be gobsmacking. They had to sell on newsstands and in newsagents and, railway stations. So they had to look, they had to be eye-catching from, 20, 30 yards away.
So no matter what the topic, let's put a lady in, with large breasts bursting out of her dress.
If possible. So the crime, the true crime, the non-fiction magazines, for example, some of which in the stuff that's in the exhibition at the State Library of New South Wales has restricted itself entirely to Australian crime. There's no overseas stories. It's quite nationalistic that way. But some of it's set in, colonial times or the bush, and ex-convicts or convicts or bush rangers. Everybody looks like a Hollywood film star in the cover illos. Every lady is a femme fatale, regardless of the actual historical circumstances.
Well, that was the way in which the homegrown story of the pyjama girl was always told, wasn't it? Of a sort of sexy tale, whereas in fact it's a terribly pathetic, depressing sort of story. Anyway, let's talk about Frank Johnson, because he's central to the exhibition you've put on. Who's he?
Yeah, well, he the more one looks, the more interesting he becomes, actually. He was a close friend of artist Norman Lindsay, and even closer friend of his sons Jack and Raymond. He was in with the Sydney Bohemians in the 20s. He was the kind of go-between, fixer-upper, entrepreneur type among a bunch of poets, novelists and artists. So he was the guy who actually organised when they published their books of poetry in their high-minded literary journals.
But that's a very literary, arty scene.
Yeah, it totally is. And really, that's what he did for the first 20 years. He published Darlinghurst Nights, very famous selection of verse by Kenneth Slessor with beautiful illustrations by Virgil Riley. He published Five Bells, Slessor's book of poems about Joe Lynch. Yeah, it was all quite lofty, intended stuff. But it wasn't till World War II came and suddenly the supply of trash literature, which had really been flooding into the country in the late 30s from the US. US distributors were literally dumping their old Superman comics and true romance mags and detective magazines in Australia. And Australians were consuming it in big numbers. Suddenly that supply was cut off because the government dictated that there were to be no foreign exchange was to be wasted on publication. So there was a sort of supply gap. And at that point, Johnson, I'm assuming after 20 years of, a kind of punished bottom line, went to hell with this. And he got his artist mates together. He got his writer mates together and started churning out superhero comics, crime magazines, crime fiction, and true crime and anything else that he could move a few units of in a newsagent.
He went brazenly down market.
He did. He went down market and he stayed there.
Mm. So this kind of fiction, I said in my introduction, it appeared, I guess the American versions of it started to appear about the 1920s and it would go through to the 60s because I can remember it when I was a little boy in the 60s. But yeah. The exhibition that you've got focuses particularly on that post-war period. Where did Frank Johnson find artists who could do this sort of work?
They were pretty thick on the ground back then, actually. We've sort of forgotten it now with, you know, digital graphics and so on. But back then, there were a lot of men and quite a few women were employed to do stuff with pen and ink and sable brushes, you know, whether it write signs for a shop window or do figures for magazines and catalogues and also for shop windows. Illustration was a big thing. And illustrators were quite well known. Comics, cartoons, and just, as I say, workmanlike illustration. So Johnson happened to know a bunch of these. Emile Mercier, who was a national figure in the 60s, later on. Unc White, he was a very well-known artist back then. And a lot of these people, George Finney was another, they, in a way that's kind of hard to maybe understand now or picture now, they often straddled both purely tradey, crafty illustration, that world, and on the other hand, they would hang stuff in the Archibald Prize or Suhlman Prize and so on. They were fine artists as well, and that's exactly the milieu that Johnson moved in. They were his pals. They were the people he drank with and went to the races with. Kind of boho, artsy group.
It also helps pinpoint a moment when art and sort of popular image making start to diverge because by the time you get to the 40s, you're starting to get abstractionism and so on, a kind of art that is moving into more modernist projects. But on the other side, you've still got people who are highly skilled at drawing pictures that look like people or, drawing scenes and landscapes who are still appealing to the common viewer, I guess.
Dipti Kapoor's novel, A Bad Character, is a story of 21st century India. It's about drugs and sex and abuse and the limits on women's freedom in the world's most populated city, Delhi. The ABC's Eleanor Hall, presenter of The World Today, spoke to Dipti Kapoor at the Jaipur Literary Festival. Kapoor begins with a reading from the opening page of her novel.
My boyfriend died when I was 21. His body was left lying broken on the highway out of Delhi while the sun rose in the desert to the east. I wasn't there. I never saw it. But plenty of others saw. And they wrote about him in the paper. 12 lines buried in the middle pages. One line standing out. The last one, in which a cop he'd never met said to the reporter, "He was known to us. He was a bad character."
Dipti Kapoor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Your novel, A Bad Character, is a daring book addressing issues like drugs and sexual abuse. Why did you write it?
My first boyfriend, which was an extremely exhilarating, passionate relationship, which turned violent. He died. And I think just before he died, my father also died. So I had these two extremely, intense experiences with death. So when I started to write it, I wanted to fix a portrait of this amoral, subterranean, underground Delhi, the places that people don't normally talk about. I find that Indian novelists, they always want to write this idea that you have to have that big family novel or a novel that or a story that brings in the history of the country. I didn't want to talk about any of that. It's just the story of a girl in the city.
So what is a bad character in Indian terms?
It's interesting because it's a term you use or you hear often. It's almost a phrase that, throwaway phrase that people use when they want to describe, say a woman comes back home late, becomes a bad character. A policeman will describe a thief or anyone will say, he did this, he's a bad character. If you live in India, you hear it all the time. Oh, he's a very bad character. So it was an ironic title, but it was also a sad title. It's like a melancholic. So what if she's a bad character? And it's also about the city, because here in that character, I mean, Delhi is also, say, bad. And it's a city which lends itself to people behaving a certain way. You know, I don't think that I could have written this in any other city. I couldn't have placed this story in any other city in the world.
There is a sense from the book in which you hate Delhi. I mean, you talk about the sun sinking into the rotting river. Is that fair? Do you really hate the city?
I don't. I have a love-hate relationship with it. I see beauty and terror as you know, opposite ends of the same lines.
In your novel, the girl in the building opposite dies trying to escape. It seems to graphically sum up the desperation of women in India for freedom. So how much freedom do middle-class girls in Delhi have?
You know, the freedom is like, okay, you can go to the cinema and then you can come back home. What I find, though, is most girls, that even if they have a certain amount of freedom, they live their lives in secrecy. Maybe they can have boyfriends, or they can have even lovers, but most of the time the families won't know anything about them, and they eventually do get married to someone the family chooses. On the whole, it's still an extremely conservative society. Women are expected to behave a certain way. And if they don't, if they fall off the path, then their marriage prospects are dimmed. And what's happening now, I find, is because Delhi is such a violent city, and of course it's always in the news, the rape capital of India, girls are being told that you can't go out because you will get attacked. There's this threat of violence everywhere in Delhi. It's very implicit as well. You can feel this male gaze, you can feel the eyes, the glances all over you. I find it like a black fog just following you around everywhere. And I find it more in Delhi than any other city in India. In India, there's a certain idea that if you're a feminist, or if you're talking about rights, then it has to be in an extremely direct way. What I'm trying to say is that you should have the right to take risks. I've always said, I want to be able to plan my own destruction. And this is an idea, even Indian women are still quite conservative. I'm considered lucky, I'm privileged, I had a really good education. Yet I write a novel where a girl is bored. She makes stupid decisions, the girl in the novel. But because in India, women are supposed to be a certain way, you know. If you're a feminist, then you have to fight for the cause in the right, correct way. I've had a couple of women, a few women, really annoyed. I have really provoked them, and this is not the kind of reaction I anticipated. I thought there'd be some right-wing Hindu men getting upset with the book, and it's been interesting. Once you place a book in the world, you don't know what kind of reaction it's going to get, and who's going to have problems with it. It's also the way it's been written, I think, because you can talk about abuse and violence, but here it doesn't really say this is bad, and I think that has annoyed women. Also, the fact that in the end she doesn't get redeemed or punished. There's no message, you know. And this is what I wanted to... I didn't want the novel to have a message, because also there's all this idea of Indian women have to behave in a certain way. So there's this girl who doesn't behave and nothing happens to her. So maybe women felt betrayed by the end.
Now there's the issue of the rape of women in taxis making the headlines, and there's a lot of outrage about that, and the government does seem to be responding. Is it making a difference?
Well, the government responds, I feel, with extremely, like, you know, it's a band-aid that they put on the problem, but they don't really attack the core. The core is, I mean, it's an institutional problem. Education at, I think, school level all over India. There's a large-scale migration from rural to urban India, so that a lot of these people who are, say, the attackers are men who've grown up in extremely conservative societies where their wives or mothers almost live behind in parda and don't talk back. And then they come to Delhi or Bombay, and they see these women out there, and they're driving and they're having coffee and they're in bars and they're drinking. And then maybe one of them is a taxi driver and he's seen this woman and he's like, well, she's fair game. India is also an extremely repressed society, so if you don't start doing something, nothing is going to change. I also find that a lot of people in government are men, and old conservative men. So I don't know whether they really believe what they say. It's also because, you know, it's in the news, the media takes it up, everyone's watching internationally. So they say these things, but nothing really happens. So this is the problem.
In your novel, you talk about the Holi festival being a sort of exuberant time of childhood and then being turned against children in a sort of a revenge. What do you mean?
So have you ever seen Holi in India? So, you know, it's like when they're playing with colours and then they can, you know, I find that often something that's extremely joyous, especially when you're young and you love to do this, you know, play and smear each other with colour, spills over into violence. So you suddenly have these drunk men out on the road who come and start touching you. I mean, it didn't happen to me, but I've seen it around me. I mean, this was like the implicit, I suppose, political stand I was taking, that, you know, something like this can easily spill over into sexual violence. And also about the fact that young girls are extremely vulnerable in India. So that was, you know, that was what I was trying to say, that this incredible festival can suddenly become extremely terrifying. My grandma told me these stories, and this is when she was working in the government as a doctor, and she would get phone calls in the middle of the night, and there'd be a young girl. She'd been abused because she had to go out in the fields. And then my grandmother would be called to make sure. I mean, some of them, I mean, my grandma said there was one five-year-old. And then they had to sew her up. And it was awful. I mean, and then she'd be called to testify. And she always, well, now she's 90, and I don't know how much of it is true, but she says, I always made sure, like, the defense lawyers would try and embarrass her by talking about, you know, trying to embarrass her by bringing out details that she wouldn't be able to answer, but, you know, she doesn't care. So she said, I always got them put in prison.
History of gutsy women in your family.
Yes, yes, I hope so.
Deepti Kapoor's novel, A Bad Character, is published by Random House. She was speaking to the ABC's Eleanor Hall. And now on Books Plus on RN, a writer of screenplays as well as novels. Deborah Oswald has written many screenplays, the latest, the very successful series, Offspring. She has also written a novel called Useful. It's the story of a man, Sullivan, Sully, whose life isn't going too well. In fact, he decides that the only way he can give meaning to his life is to give away a kidney, which seems a bit extreme. So why, wondered Michael Cathcart, is he so very down on himself?
Well, he's one of those guys who was sort of, in his 20s, was smart and good-looking and charming enough, but he kind of was so lazy and in his soul a bit damaged, and life moved on. People turned into adults, and he didn't.
No. And he's still borrowing money from his friends.
And drunk most of the time and letting people down, and he's just full of shame.
Hmm. As you can gather, listener, the book opens with him contemplating suicide. In fact, he mucks up his attempt to kill himself by jumping off the roof. Instead, he slips backwards on the roof and he knocks himself out. And that's the kicking off point for the story. Now, obviously, this is a pretty dangerous plot device because killing yourself is not funny.
No, it's absolutely not. And I hope I haven't implied that or made light of it. But I think life is ridiculous. Life is this very interesting brew of the ridiculous and the sad and the joyful. And I think that all those things can coexist in a story.
Yeah, I mean, this is the achievement of the book in a way, the first achievement anyway, that I started reading and thought, oh, no, Deb, oh, no, no, no,
what
no.
have you done?
Oh, my Lord, you've got a guy jumping off the roof, he's going to top himself. This is not funny. This is going to play very, very badly. But actually, you totally get us there because his life has become an absurdity and
yes,
we're with you. Anyway, Sullivan wakes up in hospital and he makes the decision, which is really the thing that kicks off everything that happens in the book. He decides that he'll donate a kidney, that's going to make him useful.
So he's lying there in the hospital bed and he's thinking about the fact that he was going to smash all these perfectly healthy organs on the concrete. And he thinks, well, someone might as well get some benefit from my organs. So he'll do that.
Before they get... Yes.
So he fixes on that as a thing to keep himself going.
And then there's a kind of tension in the book because we start wondering, well, is he going to give away this kidney of his and then top himself.
Yes.
Is that what's going to happen? And then the other thing he's got to deal with is that you can't just, it turns out you just can't walk into the renal unit and say, whip out the kidney and give it to a stranger.
No.
Partly because his kidneys are in such bad nick.
Well, his kidneys aren't bad. His liver's,
oh,
his liver's not in great shape.
Yeah, his liver's not bad. So they say, well, you've got to get healthy first.
Yes. And so, yes, there's all these hurdles you have to get over, and including psychiatric assessment to be an altruistic donor. It's a very particular category of donor. And so it's a kind of quest for him to, it's a quest story for him to pass all these tests.
He sees himself through the eyes of the nurse when he shows up at the renal unit. Perhaps just read us that one sentence where you, on page 28, where you give us a sense of how he knows that she sees him.
Well, he says, a homeless, unemployed, unloved man, overweight, under-muscled, greasy-haired, pasty-skinned, his forehead scabbed and bruised from the fall, one eyeball stained red thanks to a burst blood vessel, wearing paper underwear, over-eager like a panting Labrador, babbling at her about giving his kidney away to a stranger.
Yeah, he knows that's how
he
she
appears.
Sees him.
Yes.
Now, this is a challenge that you've set yourself, to write a book about a guy who is, to put it harshly, a loser.
Yes. Although he does have a good heart, if he's got a thoughtlessness that means he often doesn't act on his good heart. I think he's a fundamentally decent human being, and he doesn't judge people, which I think is a very fine quality.
He's a decent human being in the way that regular people sort of tend to be decent.
I think that's right. But I wanted to make it as hard for myself as possible. I wanted to give him absolutely no grounds on which he could feel like a useful person.
So is that the way you think as a sort of dramatist? Is this the dramatist in you coming through? Because you've given him this enormous dramatic arc, this enormous narrative arc, as we say. You've set him way down one end.
Yes.
So the question is he going to get right up the other end and save himself?
He's got, in drama terms, we often talk about it as being he's got a lot of travel.
He does.
He's got a lot of travel. I think that's more fun. I think a lot of drama takes something that we all feel, like that anxiety that we all have about, am I a useful member of the planet?
Yeah.
And we take that and then exaggerate it, because that's interesting and dramatic and funny and so forth. So I hope. He does have a long way to go.
He does have a fair haul ahead of him.
But then he's also got some good raw materials in that he's basically a nice-looking person who's let himself go to seed.
Yeah.
He's a smart person, and he's a kind person. So he's actually got quite a lot of resources.
Also, he's got an interesting social world. There are people who are looking after him, and his ex-wife is sort of making sure that someone looks after him.
Although he has used up his credit points with most of his friends.
Yes.
By burning things down and sleeping with their girlfriends, and he has, he has burned a lot of bridges.
He's not without flaws. This book is also a song in praise of radio producers.
It is. I can feel your producers behind me now, and I turn, except that I would be away from the microphone then.
Georgia Moody is the producer today. She's shouting hallelujah.
Yes, well, because my partner has worked in radio for a long time in Sydney ABC, I have observed radio producers up close, and I am always marvelling at their skill and poise and judgment and good humour.
Because you know that Richard Glover, your partner, actually is dull of wit, and the fact that he sounds so marvellous is because all these marvellous people tell him what to say.
Look,
is that what you're saying?
When you see a radio producer working on live radio in their control room, it is a splendid sight.
Yes, it is.
So one of the main characters in the book, Natalie, is a radio producer.
Yeah,
for the ABC.
Now, Richard Glover, well known to readers of the Sydney Morning Herald and to listeners of Sydney 702. Is your partner. You got together 35 years ago. I was pretty much there when you...
You were.
When you got together.
And you witnessed it.
I did. And for years, Richard has been getting mileage out of writing about you. He always refers to you as Jocasta.
Yes.
Yeah, we're giving all this away. I suppose this has been a secret for 35 years. Well, this is Jocasta, ladies and gentlemen. We're meeting her today. And I've always found this very peculiar, because Jocasta is the mother of Oedipus. It's an icky name to have.
I suppose. I was dubbed Jocasta when he wrote a column when one of our sons was little and was wanting to wrestle daddy to see who would win mummy, I think was the origin of that one.
Right.
But now I think Jocasta has, I think the name has a kind of quality that's just attached to the character I am in the column. And the thing about Jocasta is that I admire her. I think I'm nicer than her. Can you please attest to that?
Yes, you are a nice person.
But I think she's a formidable, wonderful woman.
Yeah. Can we talk briefly about offspring? I don't want to sort of haul you back to something that,
no, that's fine.
That's old news now, but how did it all come about? I mean, you had this great idea, did you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it came about, I've said this a number of times, is that all of television seemed to be full of dead bodies on slabs.
Yeah.
And I like death.
You mean all those forensic shows?
Lots of forensic shows, and I mean they still exist, and you know, and that's great. Good luck to them. And I have killed many people on stage.
I find it icky, to be honest. I find it really peculiar that you go from station to station to station. There are people cutting up other dead people, and we're all watching it. I think it's very odd.
Quipping to each other while they do it.
Very
I know
odd.
It's not my taste, but I accept that. I understand the appeal, and I'm not against death in drama. I mean, I've killed. I think every play of mine, I've killed someone.
Sure, you must have a birth and a death, as I always think is a good rule for a play.
But I felt there was room for other stuff on television, stuff that I wanted to watch. And so I thought the opposite of death is birth. So, and I wanted to write something about a big, messy family. So I just got the idea of an obstetrician and threw her into the middle of this big, messy family and pitched the idea to the producer, John Edwards.
And the rest is history.
Well, no, the rest was then 4 years in which no network wanted the show.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it was history.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a funny world when you've been around a long time. You get very sanguine about the ups and downs of it all.
It was such a relief to me when that came on. I can remember my excitement when the first episode went to air because it was funny, it was smart, it was well written, it was well acted.
Yes, they're so good, aren't they?
So what other elements do you reckon you got right?
I was lucky enough that I had two amazing co-writers who worked on the show with me, Jonathan Gavin and Michael Lucas and other people. So I think that there is a kind of alchemy about a certain team of cast and directors and writers that works. I think people really wanted a sense of community, the sense that all those very flawed people ultimately cared about each other, even though they behaved appallingly at times. The family and that workplace community ultimately cared about each other, and I think people are drawn to that because people yearn for that.
Yeah.
And I think that mix of comedy and drama is appealing to people because, in a way, it's appealing to me because that feels more like real life and reflecting the way we're all moving around in the world.
Do you feel as though you've found your medium now with TV?
I feel like the two things that I'm most enjoying as a consumer, the two things are really good television drama and novels. And so I want to write in the media that are exciting me. And right. I think television drama at the moment is fantastic and novels at the moment are very satisfying and interesting and I love that. So I want to do those things.
Deborah Oswald, making a case for TV scripts and novels as dynamic cultural forms. And her book, Useful, is published by Penguin. Now on Books Plus, I want you to imagine a future in which music shapes the world as language and currency. It can be used as a weapon to control a populace and erase memory. New Zealand poet and musician Anna Smale has written a novel in which music is both beautiful and menacing. Memory is erased every day by the ruling class, who play elaborate music on a carillon that hypnotises and controls. This dystopian world is recognisably London, but many things have changed. There's no written language, and so all memory and history is inscribed on bodies or objects and is both elusive and political. Anna Smale spoke to me from a radio studio in Wellington, in New Zealand. Anna Smale, congratulations on the Chimes.
Thank you, thank you.
Your narrator, Simon, can you introduce us to Simon and what he's carrying?
Simon, he's sort of an everyman figure, I suppose. He's sort of 15, 16. He's abandoned, he's an orphan, and he's travelling by himself into London. And yes, he has this bag, and in it is basically his life, his memories. And he's a watcher, he's a thinker, he's somebody who actually is quite linguistic and who's aware of language and aware of sort of sound interplays in language. You know, we can't tell necessarily because he's a narrator, but you know, and he's the only sort of access we have to reality. But his way of putting together words, I sort of thought of that as quite unique to him. He tends to combine descriptions. So you've got sort of compound words, portmanteau words, like river mark and, you know, colours which get pushed together. He's somebody who I think moves in language naturally, but then he doesn't have the written word. He doesn't have the ability to sort of see that as part of his world.
So Simon comes to London, this strange world full of sounds and memories that are then erased every day.
Mm.
And he meets a band of other young people.
That's
people
right.
Who, how would you describe them? They sort of live on the edge.
Yeah, well, I saw them as other orphans because, you know, it's obviously a world in which, I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, there's quite a high rate of mortality. Early death is not unusual. You know, these are, I guess, kids essentially who are on the edges of society. Definitely, they haven't taken apprenticeships, so there's a sort of a guild system. It's very sort of pre-modern, and they're kids or young adults who haven't sort of fit into the structure of society. Their function in society, I suppose, is as sort of salvages of this rare metal, palladium, which is a sort of a key part of the economic structure that the world is built upon. So their ability is, they have better hearing, slightly better memory maybe for music. And as a reader will find out, those two factors are crucial to successfully finding palladium, or the Pale Lady as they call it, in the tunnels underneath the Thames in London.
What are the chimes as a sound? What do they do?
That's a really good question, because I think a lot of the way I built the idea of the chimes, it started off as quite an abstract concept. Obviously, it's sort of based on the idea of the actual instrument, the carillon or the carillon, as we tend to say it in New Zealand. But it was sort of a mashup between that instrument and I had a very strong idea of an organ sound. So I guess the pipes are, hence, you know, the pipes are instrumental to the organ. You know, the crucial element of it is that it also involves infrasound. So there's subsonic vibrations that the instrument generates. And, you know, that's a crucial part of its effect on the populace. So I tend to think of it as it's sort of beyond description. It's sort of beyond words, which is sort of the point of the book, I guess.
So we're in a world in which these chimes sound out at a particular point in the day and have an impact on the people. But it takes a while as a reader to work this out. We're not sure of the rules of the world.
Yes.
What did you grapple with as a writer, working out how much to spell out and how much to leave to our imagination as readers?
Well, it was a really interesting process writing the novel. It was my first novel, and I think my experience as a writer was actually very similar to Simon's experience as a narrator, and probably to the reader's experience. I had this very strong conviction of the shape of the novel and the movements that the novel needed to go through, the rhythms, I guess. And I knew the plot, but revealing the information in a way that made sense and that that allowed the story to be told was something that actually gradually revealed itself to me. So I was sort of learning the rules as I went along, and I sort of set myself a very difficult task of creating a first person narrator who doesn't have short term memory or has very limited short term memory. So, you know, he's writing and he's thinking in the present tense. And yet I had to reveal backstory and I had to allow forward movement to take place. So it couldn't just be, you know, him repeating the same day over and over again, which, you know, was essentially his life. So I tried to reconcile those two things, I suppose, and I tried to kind of capture the intensity of living in a moment, which you almost can't escape from, sort of a present day.
So, Anna, there's a lot going on there. You mentioned memory, and I'd like to get to that a bit later. But if we can just stick with the world that you've created, it's sort of London, but it's defined by sound and music. Why did you start with the sound of the world? Is it because you're a musician?
I think definitely that's where the sort of first germs and seeds of the idea came to me from. Like, I have had a very intense and ongoing relationship with music. So the essence of the idea was, it was quite personal, I suppose, and quite autobiographical, based on, I suppose, quite a love-hate relationship with music, and my own background as a violinist, and coming to terms with whether that was going to be my vocation, you know, whether I was going to pursue that as a career. So that's definitely where the idea of it came from. But I was living in London when I had the idea for the book as a sort of a concerted whole. And I mean, I think it just, those two things sort of came together in quite a natural way. I think the soundscape of a city is very much part of my experience of a city. And when you're living in a city, you're not necessarily being analytical about it. You sort of take this reading or impression of the city. I suppose to me that it always shaped how I'd experienced London as well. So sort of part reality, part autobiography at that time.
Because this is another world in almost a dystopian future. And so the way that the music defines the space is through, for example, every trade has its own signature tune.
Yes.
So given that you and I know the book, but the listeners don't, can you just explain how music defines the space of the city?
I sort of had this idea of a musical language, and there are actually a few extant musical languages out there, but I suppose the idea for things like trade songs, in part they're based a little on the fact that, you know, traders in markets, pre-industrial, even now, use sound to capture buyers. And I think another influence was Bruce Chatwin's Songlines, where he describes Aboriginal myth, sort of creation myth, in which, you know, Australia is sung into being by the different gods, I believe. I may have that slightly wrong, and I'm not sure if Chatwin was entirely accurate in his perception either, but it made an impression on me. I thought this is an amazing idea. So I think it was a sort of a variety of confluences, different ideas that came to me and sort of blended together, and I hope that in a convincing way.
So this music is a powerful part of day-to-day life.
Mm.
It can also help you remember directions and go places.
Yes.
But another central issue in this world that you alluded to is that memory is lost.
That's right.
Why memory? What's your interest in that?
I've been thinking about this recently because a few people have asked about memory as a sort of the trope in the novel. And I have actually come to the conclusion that it's something I've been obsessed with for a very long time. And I've actually sort of read back through a few, I used to keep journals, sort of diaries, from quite an early age. And I sort of, one common theme running through them is this sense of holding on to memory and sort of, I guess, a sort of idealistic sense of sort of trying to live up to a sort of a version of myself that's in the past as well. Like a sort of a very unusual thing for a teenager to sort of be very conscious of trying to hold on to memories. You know, I don't know quite where this came from. The narrator in the Chimes, Simon, you know, there's this a series of losses that he's undergone, a series of traumas. And then it seems to me the ultimate pity when, you know, that you've lost a memory, you know, the saddest memory or the most tragic memory. Yeah, I think I've always been fascinated by how memory is us, how it makes our identity. And the sort of the miracle, I suppose, of the fact that we put together these sort of discrete moments and we create a narrative out of them.
So, Anna, you've taken these conceptual arguments or concerns of yours and turned it into what's a very compelling and slightly strange novel. It is a futuristic world. There are traces of the world that we know now. But how would you describe your book as a genre? Where do you place it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I tell you the truth, I did not really think about this a great deal while I was writing it. And actually, when I was writing the novel, I thought I was writing a young adult novel, and I think in part it is a young adult novel. I wrote it, I think in some way, sort of for my younger self, you know, emotionally. But I think I was also writing very much in the influence of Russell Hoban's amazing dystopian novel, Ridley Walker, which is a book in a similar vein that sort of is a future that is returned to a kind of pre-modern England. And to me, that book, it sort of transcends genre. It's ostensibly it's sci-fi, it's dystopian, but it's, to my mind, you know, it's high literary fiction. It's brilliantly and poetically written, and it touches, you know, on sort of really elemental mythic qualities. So I think that kind of liberated me from thinking about genre. I didn't feel as though I was writing a sci-fi novel, or, I mean, obviously I knew that it was a dystopia, it's pretty clear, but I didn't really think about, as you know, in terms of a genre. I think genre is a tool, and I don't think it should ever be used to narrow or limit. I think, you know, we can keep it as open as possible, and I think there's so much confluence between, you know, literary fiction and genre fiction.
Do you see it as ultimately bleak or hopeful?
I see it as hopeful. I mean, the arc of the narrative is, I think, hopeful. I think it's not an easy ending, partly because there is work to do, and it's not a sort of a finite, you know, moment of triumph. But I didn't really want to create a world in which things would sort of be black and white, and which would be easy.
Anna Smale's novel The Chimes is published by Scepter. She was speaking to me from New Zealand. I'm Kate Evans, and this is Books Plus on RN. Another Australian novel now on Books Plus from the writer Peter Tuig. The book is called The Torch, and it follows on from his earlier novel, The Cartographer. It's set in the working-class suburb of Richmond in inner Melbourne in 1960. Someone has burnt down the Blaney family's house. Their clear culprit is a 12-year-old pyromaniac, Keith Flameboy Kavanagh.
The suspect, Keith Kavanagh, and his mother have moved into their house just a few weeks before the book begins. And the reason they've moved in is because their own house has been burnt down by young Keith, as a matter of fact, who's a firebug. And so the hero's family takes them in, and then 2 weeks later, their own house disappears.
Keith's at it again.
Well, apparently. And
yes.
So our hero, young Blaney, he decides to, because Keith goes bush, so Blaney decides that no matter what happens, he is going to find this kid and he's going to help him and protect him.
Now, this is the weird part, because as you say, young Blaney, whose first name we don't know, but the boy who's your hero and who's telling us the story, doesn't seem to blame Keith the way the rest of us do. In fact, he wants to save Keith from the police and from all these angry people. Why isn't he furious like everybody else?
He's a very understanding kid, actually. He doesn't blame people. He tends to blame God when things go wrong, not people. And why not? And so he's very keen on saving Keith because he knows what it's like to suffer, and he doesn't want Keith to suffer. He lost his twin brother about a year before the book begins, and so he's in a state of shock, basically, over that. He's still trying to find a way to grieve. And he makes a decision quite early in the book that he is going to not let Keith down the way he let his brother down.
Yeah, well, that death, the death of Tom, the twin brother, really is a sadness that runs through the first novel, The Cartographer.
Quite, and it's quite dramatic.
And it's still here.
Mm, yep.
Yeah.
That's right.
So in book one, the cartographer, the boy who is our storyteller sees himself as a sort of superhero. That's why he wants to be a cartographer. And in that first book, he's in a way, while he goes around drawing maps, he's really trying to work out his own place in the cosmos, isn't he? He's sort of mapping himself.
Yes, he's living in a state of terror, as a matter of fact, because he has witnessed a murder, and that takes place really early in the book, first chapter. And so he spends the rest of the book in a state of fright, trying to avoid this character who committed this murder, who's at large and local.
Yeah, so that's in book one. I mean, it does seem to me he's still engaged in that project. He's still trying to figure out how the universe works and what his place in it is.
He talks about that off and on. He talks about the subject of coincidence, for example. He needs to find a way through the mess that he's got himself into, because everybody knows that he knows where Keith Kavanagh is hiding. And so he cops a lot of flack about this, but he refuses to cooperate with the police, the fire brigade, his parents, with anybody. He's a bit of a rogue. He becomes a bit of an outlaw.
He certainly is. And his mum's so marvellous. She's such a formidable woman. Tell us about his mum.
Yeah, she's a scary person. It turns out that she was a lieutenant during the Second World War, and there weren't many of those women lieutenants in the Women's Royal Australian Army service, but she was one of them. And he hears all kinds of stories about her through the family, most of them bullshit, but he thinks that she's a very a dangerous character, and he keeps his eye on her all the time. She knows that he's a rogue and a scullywag because he's a chip off the old block, and I don't mean his father, but I'm talking about his grandfather, her father, who's a criminal.
This grandfather, he's a major, major scallywag, and he's a type of man I have actually met, sort of working class guys who were quite open about the fact that they made their living as thieves.
That's right. He's quite open. He makes no secret of it. He's a money lender. He's a thief. He's a bookmaker. He's got contacts. He's a friend of the Archbishop. Not many people were a friend of the Archbishop in 1960, especially people who lived in Richmond, but he is one of them, because he's known him since Mannix came to Australia. So he's known him a long time, and they get on. And he uses that contact to help the kid, because Mannix has such power.
Yeah.
Even though he was on his last legs, he still had a lot of power.
Yeah, Mannix, to explain, is the Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne during that period, Daniel Mannix, who lived to the ripe old age of 99, I think.
That's right. Who started off as a hero of the Irish and ended up a bit of a bastard, actually.
Yes.
From the point of view of the Richmond people.
Yes, he's a complex character. He certainly is a complex character. Right. So he arrives in Melbourne as a young, fiery Irishman, as Archbishop, and just basically presides over the Catholicism in that city for, than a lifetime, for generations,
right.
It seemed. Mm. I mean, the Blaneys are Catholics, and it's taking us back to a time when the Catholic-Protestant divide was a major social barrier, at least in many of the places I know about. Was Richmond a suburb in which that kind of sectarian self-consciousness was a force?
There wasn't a big divide for the simple reason that the whole place was Catholic.
Oh, right. That didn't solve it.
It was a dumping place for the Irish. That was how the town was created. And so the Blaneys just fit in nicely, and they don't even think about the Protestants much. They don't really know many. The kid does. I call him the kid Blaney. He's got a few mates who aren't Catholics, but he doesn't care. I mean, they're just kids.
So this is the world of your own childhood, is it, Peter?
That's right. Yep, I grew up in that area.
And
in Richmond.
And as you tell the story, it sounds as though little kids were pretty free to do what they wanted out there.
They could do anything they liked, basically. I can't think of anything they couldn't do, providing they weren't caught.
So when you say that, what kind of stuff did you yourself get up to in those?
Well, now, I wouldn't like to commit myself to that one, because I got up to a lot of stuff. But I was basically one of those good kids.
You know, I think the statute of limitations has probably run its course since 1960. You can probably confess to anything and
actually,
not have to do time.
I feel that it hasn't, for some strange reason.
Is that right?
But there's a scene where the kid mentions, for example, stealing a street sweeper. Well, that's actually something that I did do. That's a long time ago.
You knocked off a street sweeper. No, I'm not going to let you go on this. I mean, how does a young boy go about the business of knocking off a street sweeper?
It's quite easy, really. I mean, people who drive street sweepers have to get off and buy the paper and have a pee and so on, and you just hop on and drive it off.
Oh, yeah.
Mind you don't get a long way. Those things don't go very fast.
No, it's hard to put them into turbocharge and disappear in a cloud of dust. In fact, you're sucking up the dust as you go, probably.
Yeah.
And matches have a special relevance in this story, because Richmond is, in some sense, the home of the match.
That's right. It's the world centre of the match.
Explain.
Bryant & May was a British match manufacturer. They basically made matches for the world, and they moved to their factory in England, burnt down. And they moved to Melbourne, and their factory survived. And it was quite close to where I used to live, so I saw it every day. And I thought, I'll incorporate that, because after all, the book's about a firebug.
And one of the landmarks of the town was actually the clock tower on the factory, which had the words Bryant and May as the digits on the... If you count them out, there are 12 letters there.
Still there, I think.
Fortuitously in Bryant and May. Yeah. So you say this book... Well, this is what the press release says, so I guess you okayed this, that this is a book about innocence. Can you talk to me about that?
Yes. The child who features in the book, the kid, he really is an innocent kid, even though he's about as innocent as Ed Kelly. He has a way of looking at the world which is really quite forgiving and accepting. And I think we would equate that in any normal kid with innocence. But, of course, he's not normal because he's entirely formed by his views of the adults around him, who are all criminals. His speech, his slang, his way of thinking, it's all a result of his contact with bad people, including nuns and priests and brothers and so on. So he can't be blamed, I think, for the way he is. But he's not really a bad person. He's actually quite a good person. And he talks about his relationship to God quite openly. And we see that his relationship with his mother and with other women around the place, prostitutes and so on, who he comes in contact with. And we see that he really wants to be friends. He wants them to be who they are. He doesn't really want them to be different. He doesn't even want his mother to be different, even though she doesn't like him anymore.
And Peter, as you tell us this story, privately, when you're at home writing it, are you working out things about yourself?
No, I'm just... in fact, when I first started writing The Cartographer, I really didn't have much of a plan at all. I just simply had an idea for a story and I started writing it, and it just sort of told itself. Now, when I wrote this book, the sequel, really, it was the same. I didn't really have a big plan. I had an idea. I had a rough plan. And I just started writing the book, and it wrote itself. It's told in the first person, so the narrator simply tells the story to me, and I write it down. And I feel that it's a bit like being a medium in a way.
Do you know his first name?
No, I don't, actually, but I've thought of a few. Every now and then I think of his name, but really when he's talking, I'm never thinking of him as having a first name. But if I was forced to use a first name, I'd have one already lined up. But I have no intention of using that.
Peter Tuig, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Peter Tuig's The Torch is published by HarperCollins. And we've reached the edge of the bookshelf today here on Books Plus. Next week, a Catalan novel that connects the 12th century with the present, written by John le Carré's granddaughter. That probably shouldn't make a difference, but it sort of does. So do join me again next week. Meanwhile, keep listening to RN. Bye for now.